Keep telling your youth that mud and danger are fit only for intellectual pigs. Keep on saying that only the stupid are fit to sacrifice, that America must be defended by the lowbrow and enjoyed by the highbrow. Keep vaunting head over heart, and soon the head will arrive at the complete folly of any kind of fight and meekly surrender the treasure to the first bandit with enough heart to demand it. But Dr. Gentle seemed not to perceive the pride behind my words, and so I stammered and made some weak joke about it and hoped he would change the subject. "Oh, by the way," he said, "I have that gun of yours. How would you like to sell it to me? I'd like to send it home as a souvenir." "Sorry, sir, but I can't. It's not mine." "Too bad," he said, rising. "But if you should change your mind, let me know. The folks back in Atlanta'd get a kick out of it." He looked at me thoughtfully. "There isn't very much to be done about that enuresis of yours. A corpsman will wake you at intervals during the night. You aren't restricted to the ward, like the other patients. You can go to the movies and eat at the regular hospital mess. Oh, and remember, no more of that razor blades kind of thing." That night a corpsman awakened me each hour. The next night he did the same, and the following night. But the fourth night, there was no call, and the enuresis claimed me again. So the awakenings were resumed, then without warning stopped. Active still. It was obvious what they were doing. They were only trying to establish the legitimacy of my complaint. For this affliction is a common dodge of fakers and malingerers anxious to gain a medical discharge. Because it was a general suspicion, I did not resent it, and soon I even forgot about it. Life was much too pleasant in the P-38 ward, and there were too many interesting things happening. Perhaps I should have said odd things. Among the oddest was Captain Midnight, and it may have been from him that the ward gained its fancy name. During the day he was an avid reader of comic books, especially the strips about the adventurer Captain Midnight. At night, he was Captain Midnight. He would rise from his cot, stretch out his arms as though they were wings, hunch up his shoulders and race on tiptoe about the ward, lifting and dipping his wings and canting his body like an airplane, all the while emitting a droning buzz. "Captain Midnight, call in the airfield," he would call. "Captain Midnight, call in the airfield." Immediately the ward took up the cry. "Hey, Captain, watch out there. There's a zero on your tail. Ack, ack ahead. Careful of the flat, Captain. Nice going, Cap. You shot that zero clear to hell." The kid was confined behind the bars which kept the violent patient separated from us. I saw him there, to my surprise. He looked at me sheepishly and asked me for some candy, which I gave him. I could not refrain from gazing at his hands, for it was the kid who had strangled the Jap. They were the short, square hands of the painter. Powerful. How much, I mused, had that deed to do with his insanity? How much was retribution? How much remorse? Or was there a difference? I asked a corpsman about the kid. "He blew his stack," he said simply. The corpsman had been on Pavuvu and knew the terrain. "You know that road around the island, and the little airplane that they park on the road? Well, this kid went down to the road one day and climbed into the plane. They grabbed him when he started the motor. Somebody asked him where he thought he was going. Home, he said, I'm getting the hell out of here, so they brought him here instead." They had brought him to Banica instead. Not as long a trip as the kid's insanely conceived flight home, but it would get him there eventually. The kid's war was over. He would go home, and probably regain his sanity when he got there. The unbearable pressure would be off. How much pressure will it take for me, I wondered. How much longer will I hold out? Insanity had been my foremost fear since the moment I had vaulted over the side of the Higgins boat on Guadalcanal and seen those spiky fronds swinging overhead. To be killed, even to be taken prisoner by a cruel and vindictive foe, seemed preferable to madness. And I had always thought madness possible, not so much from within, from the pressure of events upon the mind, but from without, from a bullet, a piece of shrapnel, concussion. I had thought it physical rather than psychical. Here in the mental ward, I saw that I was wrong. I saw what a man's own mind, what despair could do to him. I am thinking of the pitiful beings they call manic depressives. These are the sons of despair. I saw them. I felt the dejection of their spirit. And I wondered sadly what could have happened to a man to turn him into a ghost walking the ward with silent lips and blank eyes. If Banica was an island paradise, it had for enlisted men its forbidden fruit. The nurses. It isn't personal, explained the corpsman who had told me about the kid. It's just that they're women, and women out here are just no good. They cause too much trouble. He reflected a moment. You know, we didn't have nurses when we first got to Banica. It was just the doctors and ourselves. He sighed wistfully. It was wonderful. The doctors shared their liquor rations with us and everything. It was like one big happy family. We ate good, too. As good as the doctors. You never heard of a doctor pulling his rank. We got along wonderfully together. His face darkened. Then the nurses came, and everything changed overnight. We weren't good enough anymore. No more liquor, no more top chow, no more friendliness. The nurses talked only to doctors, and the doctors talked only to God. And the trouble is, our work hasn't gotten one bit easier. If anything, it's harder. What with the tension, his face got gloomier. And look what the nurses did to the whole base. Look at the fancy stockade they had to build for them and get a whole MP battalion to stand guard over them. Look at how the men eat their heart out every time they see an officer riding around in a jeep with a nurse beside him. And how do you think they feel when they see the officer has a pistol on his hip? What the hell does that mean, eh? It means he's supposed to defend this pure woman's honor against an attack by us crummy enlisted men. We're the only ones that'd do it, you know. The lieutenant's glands have been the officer's candidate school. His voice was bitter now. It's crazy. It's unfair. Women have no place out here. Not just a few of them anyway. If they can't send a woman for every man, they better keep them all the hell home. The hospital had a good library, and reading became an obsession with me. I read 2 or 3 books a day, scorning the nightly movies, often reading in the head after lights out. But at last I did go to the movies, when even my seemingly insatiable appetite for reading had been sated, and when there had begun to stir within me a vague sense of shame. The softness of my life in the hospital had begun to mortify me, and occasionally I would surprise myself comparing it with contempt to the Spartan regiment of my comrades on Pavuvu. My resentment of the stateside lottery had vanished, and I had forgotten even the reason for my flight to Banica. Bored now with the books, and with everything around me, I decided to go to the movies. I accompanied a detachment of the men from the P-38 ward, who were escorted there by corpsmen. There were the usual searching looks and rippling titter when we nuts took our seats in the amphitheater of coconut logs curving around the hillside. Then the island commander entered, and everyone stood at attention. When he sat down, the movie began. There was an interruption. Over a public address system, a voice announced, "Allied troops have just invaded northern France. The second front has been opened." Cheers and exultant shouts rose into the soft night, to be followed by a buzz of excitement. But then the film began again, and silence was restored. I arose and left the amphitheater, my heart throbbing in excitement. It was difficult to comprehend this excitement. In it was mixed a thrill of pride, but predominating was the heartbeat of anxiety. For suddenly it had been borne in upon me that great events were happening, that the war was now rushing downhill to victory, and here was I, clad in pallid pajamas and robe, lounging around a hospital. Yearning came upon me in a rush, and I wept, hurrying along the dark road back to the hospital. I wanted to rejoin my comrades. The doctors sent me back to them soon after. I was summoned to Dr. Gentle's office. Seated with him at his desk was the hospital commander. I noticed Rutherford's pistol on the desk, and realized that I was not long for Benica. "There's not much that we can do for this trouble of yours," the hospital commander told me. "There's no curing it out here. What you need is a change of climate and a less nerve-wracking assignment."
"You mean shipment back to the States, sir?" I asked.
He smiled wanly. "Ordinarily, yes. Unfortunately, you Marines can't go home unless you're carried home. So we are sending you back to duty with the suggestion that your commanding officer have the sentry wake you during the night." I laughed, and he laughed, and Dr. Gentle laughed. There was no bitterness or reproach, for they knew as well as I how impossible that suggestion was. Pity the poor sentry who should have the temerity to blunder about the lines solicitous for his comrade's full bladder. There would be no trigger finger so solicitous for him, but I suppose the doctors had to say something. "Don't forget your gun," said Dr. Gentle. "Sure you haven't changed your mind about selling it?"
"Sorry, sir. No, sir.
Thanks again for your help." He nodded, and I left. I picked up my toilet gear and departed the P-38 ward and caught the next boat back to Pavuvu. 2. Pavuvu throbbed with renewed spirit. I felt it the moment I came ashore and saw the hundreds of men bathing in the bay. They were carefree again, laughing, shouting, frolicking in the bright water like porpoises, their strong bodies glistening in the sun, the bronze of their flesh accentuated by the white midriff. I could discern it in the tidiness of the tents lying in rows among the palms, the neatness of the company streets bordered by coconuts stuck into the earth, and of the busy vehicular commerce sweeping around the single road that girdled the island. There were screen-enclosed heads. There were showers. There were basketball courts blocked out on the dried clay. There was an open-air movie. There was even a laundry battalion. But best of all was this rebirth of spirit, the old sardonic sureness of the raggedy-assed. Such change is as sudden and inexplicable as a shift in the wind. The silent men take to cursing, and then they take to joking, and before the first sound of laughter has died in their throats, the change has been worked. They begin to be careful of their clothes. They shave more frequently. Someone finds a broom and sweeps out the tent. Another takes a packing box and makes a locker of it, and begins a fashion that has the whole division roaming the island for boxes or spare lumber. And finally, a basketball or a volleyball arrives from division and teams form, by platoon, by company, or by battalion. Challenges are laid down and accepted. Rivalries grow. The old designations are hurled back and forth like howitzer shells. And the great thing is abroad again. The fighting spirit is unfurling like a banner on the winds of pride, and all that remains is to draw up the plan of battle. So I met the old spirit when I came back. And I found a thing as good or better. A new friend. The scholar was among a shipload of replacements who had just arrived. They were being marched to their new units as my boat pulled up on the beach. As soon as they came to the company tents, they took off their shiny stateside khaki to exchange it for the sun-bleached uniforms of the veteran. The salty clothing prized for its aura of experience. An insecure replacement would feel more confident, clothed in the faded ensigns of the old breed. While the veterans, having no psychological problem of belonging to distort their sense of value, were quick to sense a sucker. Within a few days, the change was so complete that the veteran, who could formerly be recognized by his lusterless garb, was now identified by its shiny newness. I sat in our tent, watching in amusement, when my view became blocked by a bulging sea bag being pushed through the entrance. Behind it was a sweating replacement.
"This the intelligence section tent?" he asked, half timidly.
"Sure, come on in," I replied, eyeing that sea bag and unwrapping a bar of chocolate I had brought from Banika.
"Put it down anywhere you want." "Here," I said, breaking the bar in two. "Have some candy."
He took his half and shoved it hungrily into his mouth.
"Thanks.
We haven't eaten since we got off the ship this morning."
"What you got in that bag, huh?
Got any shoes?" I needed shoes badly, but in dismay my eyes fell upon his feet.
"What the hell size shoe do you wear?"
"Five, five and a half. Pretty small, eh?" He snickered, and I lost interest in his sea bag. And somehow he did not look like a man who would trade new khaki for old. He surveyed our tent and saw my bookcase made of a packing case.
"Hey, where did you get the books?"
"My father sends them to me."
"That's great," he said with quick enthusiasm. "I've got a load of books in the bottom of my bag. How would it be if I whipped them out and stuck them in with yours?"
"Fine," I said, making room for his books on my shelf and his friendship in my heart. It was not only the books. I recall only Roman Roland's Jean Christophe and something of Calderon in Spanish, but it was the steel that I felt in him, and perhaps most of all for the expression of stubbornness on that half-scornful face. So we became friends and remained so still. After the scholar came four more replacements for our section, who were quartered in our tent. Two of them were hardly more than high school boys, each about 18. The one quarrelsome, the other tractable, the first a Midwesterner, the second a Southerner. The quarreler aggressive and intelligent and often offensive, the mild lad shy and slow and likable. Though dissimilar, they stuck together and became the twins. White Man was the third replacement. From the hills of Virginia, White Man was a bigot. From the tip of his blunt-toed feet to the top of his high and narrow and brindle-haired head.
"Lucky," he said to me once. "Know what we gonna do after the war? We gonna clean up the niggas. And when we finish with the niggas, we gonna start on the Catholics."
The tent roared with laughter, for only a humorless bigot would resent White Man's amiable animus. White Man was also the first drafted Marine of my experience. The Corps had begun to accept draftees from the general pool, not many, but enough to weaken our own proud position as an elite. This was the only time White Man rubbed us the wrong way. When he spoke scathingly of volunteers, "You damn fools asked for it."
"I didn't. They had to come and get me."
Only our silence could express our contempt. Filthy Fred, the fourth new man, was a raw-boned, eagle-beaked, easy-going farm lad from Kansas, full of the lore of the barnyard and with something of a rooster's approach to life. He was fond of applying the standards of barnyard crises to those of human life, and was not only boring, but disgusting, often provoking cries of outrage from these less-than-squeamish Marines. With these replacements, life on Pavuvu now turned to training designed to integrate the new men into the division. But many of the old salts disdained to go through that dull, dispiriting routine again, and did as I did, secured a sinecure that kept them back in the battalion area. Others, like the artist, simply stayed aloof. Like Achilles, the artist sulked in his tent. Many a morning at 10 o'clock, after I had finished my duties with Lieutenant Liberal, the battalion censor, duties which consisted in licking envelope flaps and sealing them closed, I came to the artist's tent bringing a few slices of bread begged from the galley. The artist would break out the little cans of caponata which his mother sent him regularly, and I would boil coffee and we would have a feast. Coffee made the evenings, too. After the movies, the men would drop in to drink from the pot I had prepared. Warmed by this black liquid, they would talk and argue and jokingly discuss the comparative merits of my coffee making and the rival beverage of the quartermaster sergeant. They would flatter me on my cooking.
"Best damn cup of joe on Pavuvu."
but I think it was the conversation and not the coffee that drew them to my tent. My kitchen was not equal to the QM sergeant's. He cooked his coffee over an acetylene torch, while I was reduced to boiling it in an old can over a tomato can filled with gasoline. But if he had the cuisine, my place had the atmosphere. The books belonging to the scholar and me, most especially the almanac and the dictionary, made our tent a meeting place for the battalion literati. Then there was always an argument to be had with Eloquent, who was most obliging in opposing anyone. Then, too, there was the attraction of taking coffee from the hand of an Asiatic. This last is a term expressing the mixed reverence and fear for a man who has been in the tropics too long. I learned from Eloquent to embrace such a designation, for it made one an untouchable, almost, and automatically excluded one from dirty duty, and the more prosaic forms such as falling out for calisthenics at Reveille. My having spent 4 weeks in the P-38 ward on Banica made me the Asiatic par excellence. In my case, it was official, so none of the officers objected when I took to sealing the envelopes every morning for Lieutenant Liberal, avoiding all other duty, or when I clothed myself in a pair of moccasins and a khaki towel wrapped around my waist like a Melanesian's lap-lap. They shrugged and tapped their heads and called me Asiatic. Now, a person thought to be different can exercise a peculiar attraction among men, and one result of my reputation was that every night, when I had finished writing letters on the rickety old typewriter I had bought for $10, I could expect the tent to fill up with the men returning from the movie, eager for a cup of joe and perhaps a full-scale argument between the two Asiatics, Eloquent and me. Sometimes, a bottle of whiskey would find its way to our tent. Either purchased for some outrageous price, or, on one occasion, blackmailed from Lieutenant Liberal when he, deciding that the men of the intelligence section should stand guard with the others, let fall the fatal remark, "I am an egalitarian myself," and was immediately requested to extend his principles to his liquor ration. If the whiskey ran out too soon, I would coax a canteen of jungle juice from the Chuckler's tent, or else we would drink our shaving lotion or hair tonic. Once I drank a horrible green concoction called Dupré, and awoke with a tongue that seemed to have been shaved and shampooed. With alcohol rather than coffee, our voices rose from talk to song. Once again, it was the ribaldries and the songs of World War I, and we even sank to a pitiful low when we began to hum classical symphonies in unison, a depth from which we were rescued by a macabre composition of our own, inspired by the news that the division was ready to go again. To the tune of Finiculi Finicula, we sang a ghoulish serenade. We would form a circle around a man and sing, "Yamo, yamo, Playboy's gonna die. Yamo, yamo, Playboy's gonna die. He's gonna die, he's gonna die, he's gonna die. So what the hell's the use? You're gonna die, you're gonna die." We sang it to all, to everyone, except Liberal, the artist, and white man. Word began to spread that the next one would be quick. It would not be like Guadalcanal or New Britain. It would be rough, real rough while it lasted, but then, home for the old salts. We rejoiced. That was the best way, short and sweet. Rutherford recovered his pistol. He came one night when all were at the movies, and I was alone in the tent. Typing a letter by the light of a piece of rope dipped in a can of gasoline, he and a friend came in out of the darkness like conspirators. I was glad to be relieved of it, for I had been afraid someone would steal it from me. "See you in the old hometown," Rutherford said, and slipped back into the dark with his comrade. We left Pavuvu. Victors of Guadalcanal and New Britain, we went out to fight again, marching into the open-jawed landing craft driven up on the beach. Never before were we so confident of victory. Never again would its price be so high. 3. Peleliu was already a holocaust. The island, flat and almost featureless, was an altar being prepared for the immolation of 17,000 men. Army and Navy planes had pounded her. A vast naval armada of heavy cruisers and battleships had been lobbing their punishing missiles onto that coral fortress for days before our arrival. The little atoll, only 5 miles long, perhaps 2 at its broadest, was obscured beneath a pall of smoke. It was a cloud made pinkish by the light of the flames, and at times it would quiver and flicker like a neon sign, while the rumble of an especially heavy detonation came rolling out to us. Our landing craft had disgorged our Amtraks about a half mile from shore. We had come rolling out of their bowels like the ugly offspring of a monster Martian, and had felt the impact of a vast roaring and exploding and hissing and crackling. The sound of the bombardment, and, so it seemed to us, the sound of the utter destruction of that little island. Our great warships lay behind us, and before us lay the foe. Overhead, all of the airplanes were ours. It was a moment of supreme confidence. A fierce joy gripped me, banishing that silly conviction of death, and I ran my eye over all that bristling scene of conquest. Naval shells hissed shoreward in the air above us. Those of us who had been on Guadalcanal, remembering our own ordeal with naval bombardment, could spare a pang of pity for the foe. Thankful, nevertheless, for the new direction the war had taken. Slender rocket ships and destroyers were running close in to shore, as graceful as thoroughbred horses. When the rocket ships discharged their dread salvos, there came a terrible roaring noise, like the introduction of hot steel into water, and the air above them would be darkened by flights of missiles. Now the great furor was dying down. The curtain of fire was lifting. In my exhilaration, I turned for a last look at our landing craft and saw the prow, black with sailors, waving us on, shaking clenched fists in the direction of Peleliu, as though they were spectators come to see the gladiators perform. Now at once, silence. The motors of our tractors roared, and we churned toward that cloud of smoke. I had my head above the gunwales because I had chosen to man the machine gun. So had the Hoosier in a nearby Amtrak. He caught sight of me, nodded toward the island and grinned. I read his meaning, and lifted my hand in the gesture of perfection. "Duck soup!" I shouted into the wind and noise. Hoosier grinned again, and returned the salute. And at that moment, there came an odd bump against the steel side of our craft, and then a strangled sound. The water began to erupt in little geysers, and the air became populated with exploding steel. The enemy was saluting us. They were receiving us with mortar and artillery fire. 10,000 Japanese awaited us on the island of Peleliu. 10,000 men as brave and determined and skillful as ever a garrison was since the art of warfare began. Skillful, yes. It was a terrible rain, and it did terrible work among us before we reached the beach. At that first detonation, Hoosier and I had ducked below the gunwales, and I had not dared raise my head again until we were 100 feet offshore. Our Amtrak was among the first assault waves, yet the beach was already a litter of burning, blackened amphibian tractors, of dead and wounded, a mortal garden of exploding mortar shells. Holes had been scooped in the white sand, or had been blasted out by the shells. The beach was pocked with holes, all filled with green-clad helmeted Marines. We were pinned down. With Lieutenant Deepchest of F Company, to whom Filthy Fred and the mild twin and I had been assigned, I leapt over the side of our Amtrak and scraped a hole of my own. Behind me a shell landed, blowing a man clear out of his high-laced jungle boots. He was the fellow who had been with me on New Britain when the Japs had come up behind me, the one who had fired over my head. He lived, but the war was over for him. Lieutenant Deepchest tried to say something, but I could not hear. Motioning to him to write it down, he shrugged. It was not important. Just then, a Marine came dashing over a sand dune in front of me, his face contorted with fear, one hand clutching the other, on which the tip of the index finger had been shot away, the stump spouting carmine like a Roman candle. It was the corporal who had earned Chuckler's enmity the night of the Teneriffe fight on Guadalcanal, when our machine gun, which he had set up, had slumped into the mud. Now, behind that fearful face, I thought I detected amazement and relief. We were pinned down, but not by mortars alone. Machine gun fire came from an invincible outpost which the Japanese had blasted out of a coral promontory jutting into the bay. We had found an opening in it, and even then were filling it with all manner of small arms fire, grenades, sticks of dynamite hurled by men who had crept up to it, or billowing fire from the flamethrowers who also had gained the hole. But the answering fire continued to rake our deadly picnic ground. Examining our position now, I saw that the beach lay before a line of scrub. Beyond this were the coveted airfield and the main enemy fortifications, which we were to call Bloody Nose Ridge. In the scrub I saw a yellow butterfly darting among the foliage and the waving pennant of a moving thing that turned out to be a tank, a marine tank. There came a lull, and I could hear the shout that rose when the tank rumbled into position opposite the fortress that had pinned us down. It fired shell after shell down the hole. Its machine gunner discharged a belt into it. But still, that outpost guns worked against us. Then began an odd procession. The hole suddenly was filled with the figure of a Japanese soldier. He jumped out of sight. Then another, another. Each appearance set off a mad crackle of small arms fire. We might have been shooting at rabbits, for they appeared with the quick furtiveness of rodents, disappearing just as swiftly, as though their fortress were a warren, which is what it was, for the Japanese had possessed Peleliu for 2 decades and had blasted into the coral a network of mutually supporting caves. When a Jap jumped, he was making his exit to another position, perhaps even scurrying away beneath us. One, only one, of these departing defenders died. He was fat and ponderous, with his blouse and trousers stuffed with rice like the poor chowhound consumed by the crocodiles on Guadalcanal. And because he moved so slowly, the bullet struck him in a sheet and disintegrated him in a shower of flesh and rice. It was hot. The white sand burned through our clothing. It was the enervating heat of the steam room. The sweat slid into one's mouth to aggravate thirst. The water in our canteens was hot, and when I had drunk it all, I filled it with dirty rainwater lying in shell craters. Peleliu has no water. The Japanese caught theirs in cisterns open to the sky, and ours had been floated into us in gasoline drums, from which some fool supply officer had neglected to cleanse the residuary oil. Smelling and tasting of gasoline, it was undrinkable. A brazen sun beat upon us when, freed by the silence of the fortress, we rose and marched through the scrub to the airfield. Just before the airstrip, on the edge of the scrub, lay an enormous shell crater. In this we took up positions. I met the artist. "Liberal's dead," he told me. "A mortar shell got him and the soldier." "How about the soldier? How's he?" "Tore up his leg pretty bad, but he's okay," the artist laughed. "Better than us, anyway. He's out of it." "Yeah. Too bad about Liberal, though. He was a nice guy. He got it in the stomach. I saw him sitting up against a tree when I got off the beach. He was laughing. I asked him, and he said he was fine. But he died while he was sitting there." The artist shook his head and walked away. "Too bad about Liberal. All the fine education, all the good humor on that blonde, blunt face, all the goodwill in his socialist schemes for humanity, all and everything gone, trickled away through some unknown fissure in this frail vessel of life, while the man leaned against the tree and smiled and smoked and contemplated a future made safe by an allied victory and sure by this temporarily incapacitating wound. And so he perished. May he rest in peace. We stayed in the crater. Our advance had halted. There had been many casualties. The defenders were resolute and resourceful. The Marines began to chip foxholes in the airfield coral. At noon I tried to eat, but I could not swallow even a mouthful of beans from the ration in my pack. I never ate on Peleliu. Their tanks swooped suddenly upon us. They came tearing across that airfield, a dozen or so of them. It was startling. They came out of nowhere, and here were only riflemen and machine gunners to oppose them. There was a violent outburst of gunfire. I poked my head above the crater. Through the lacy branchwork of the scrub trees, I saw an enemy tank streaking along, with snipers and camouflage hanging onto the rear. It was but a moment's glance, but at the same time, my eye caught sight of a Marine from F Company, a veteran, running bow-legged to the rear, his face writhing, shouting, "Tanks! Tanks!" An officer grabbed him and spun him around and kicked him and propelled him back to his post. In the crater, we prepared for defense, like a caravan attacked by Indians. The enemy tanks whizzed past, their little wheels whirling within their tracks. Machine guns clattered. Bazookas whammed. Our airplanes came screeching down from heaven, and there rose the detonation of their bombs and the roar of exploding tanks. Once a torpedo plane flashed by, so low its belly might have scraped the coral. To my right, I saw a line of our tanks advancing, firing as they came, seeming to stop each time their guns stuttered. Then it was over. The Jap tanks had been destroyed. I got up and made for the airfield. About 20 yards away was a burning tank. Some of the enemy dead were inside. The snipers hung in their nets, like dolls stuffed in a Christmas stocking. I turned to go, and as I did, nearly stepped on someone's hand. "Excuse me," I began to say, but then I saw that it was an unattached hand, or rather, a detached one. It lay there alone, open, palm upwards, clean, capable, solitary. I could not tear my eyes from it. The hand is the artisan of the soul. It is the second member of the human trinity of head and hand and heart. A man has no faculty more human than his hand, none more beautiful, nor expressive, nor productive. To see this hand lying alone, as though contemptuously cast aside, no longer a part of a man, no longer his help, was to see war in all of its wantonness. It was to see the especially brutal savagery of our own technique of rending. And it was to see men, at their eternal worst, turning upon one another, tearing one another, clawing at their own innards with the maniacal fury of the pride possessed. The hand sat in me, and I offered it a respectful inclination of the head, while recovering my balance and making a careful circle around it. I gained the edge of the airfield and saw the other tanks in the scattered piles of corpses. Among them prowled Souvenirs, busy with flashlight and pliers. His curled mustache bristled in anticipation. But this was Souvenir's last plundering excursion among the mouths of the dead. He was killed an hour later in an assault on an enemy position. So was Lieutenant Commando, whose epitaph Souvenirs himself had spoken. May they rest in peace. Our casualties were extremely heavy. Before the day was done, they would total 500 in the 1st Regiment, something like 20%. This, on the first day. We were advancing again. Our objective was Bloody Nose Ridge. This was the high ground visible from across the airfield. It gave the enemy perfect observation. Advancing across the flat table of crushed coral, on which there was hardly a single depression, we were as easily sighted as clay ducks in a shooting gallery. But there was no other route, and we had to take it. Grass-cutting machine gun fire swept the airfield. Mortar shells fell with the calm regularity of automation. It was as though they had determined at what rate they could kill the most of us, and were satisfied with it, unhurried in its application. Marines fell. They crumpled. They staggered. They pitched forward. They sank to their knees. They fell backward. They kept advancing. Now the day was dying amid hoarse cries for water or help for the wounded. An empty Amtrak from another unit had strayed into our sector, and Lieutenant Racehorse, seeing it, bounded alongside, sprang aboard, and ordered the driver to our front. Racehorse wanted to bring back the wounded, but the driver was not eager to obey. He was from another outfit. He was tired. He saw no reason in risking his flesh for a strange officer. He said he could not obey. Racehorse told him he had better. The driver refused openly. Racehorse drew his pistol and laid it against the driver's head and said, "Get your ass moving." And the driver quickly shifted gears and drove frontward with a roar. Racehorse had won a Navy Cross for his bravery on Guadalcanal. He won another on Peleliu, but it was awarded posthumously. He perished attacking a pillbox. May he rest in peace. Now it was growing dark, but it was still the first day of battle. We had drawn back to consolidate, and I, with Filthy Fred, lay inside the big crater again. I had tried to eat another mouthful of beans, but I could not. Tension had made my stomach a vibrating intestinal harp. Finding the water in the crater exhausted, I scrambled out and headed toward the beach, hoping to find some there. Perhaps they had gotten rid of the gasoline filthy stuff, which had already sickened many men, and had brought clean water ashore. I made my way cautiously through the brush. Runner came out of the brush. "Chicken got it," he said. "Damn fool kept pulling out the plasma needle the corpsman stuck in his arm. You know how Chicken was. Stubborn. I don't know," he said, shaking his head gloomily. "I don't know. Maybe he would have died anyway. It was a nasty wound. But he didn't help himself any. Poor kid." Runner peered at me through the dusk. I got the feeling that he had distinguished himself that day and was struggling with his modesty to tell me. "Boy, it was rough," he burst out. "Ask Chuckler. He'll tell you Guadalcanal was a pink tea compared to today. I mean, for the fighting. And this one was supposed to be easy. Should have seen it when they threw those tanks at us. We knocked them out with machine guns and hand grenades," he proclaimed triumphantly. "How's everybody else?" "Okay. Chuck and Hoosier all right. The gentleman got hit, though, but he's okay. Lucky bastard. He's had it." He peered at me again. "How about you? How'd you guys make out?" I told him about Liberal and the others, and he shook his head. "There won't be too many left after this one." "And did you notice who's getting it?" I nodded. "All the veterans." I asked him if he had found any water, but he turned his canteen upside down in reply. We walked back together, sadly, each to himself alone, wondering if this were to be the end. "Remember the guys who got it back on Guadalcanal?" Runner asked. "We used to think they were poor slobs, getting it so soon. Maybe they were the lucky ones. They didn't have to go through all this crap and wind up getting it anyway." "Maybe," I said. "But they never got to Melbourne either." "That's true. But right now I'm thinking about anything but Melbourne. I've been doing plenty of praying. And it isn't any of that no atheist in a foxhole crap either." Runner's dark oval face had never been so serious. I remembered that he had been baptized by Father Strait on Pavuvu. How different he was. How different everything was. Gone the camaraderie. Gone, Guadalcanal. Gone the pagan naivete of the first battle. How much easier to be a pagan again, and to refuse to take the thing seriously. We parted at the lip of the shell crater. I had never missed him and Chuckler and Hoosier more. It was dark now, but the noises of battle were resuming. Mortars were crashing again. From point to point on our lines rose the angry chatter of machine guns and rifles, sometimes sounding indignant, as though the Marines resented these nocturnal intrusions in the manner of a farmer chasing poachers. Even the dark retreated, for we began to use flares. They were of the kind that had illuminated our second night of warfare when they were dropped above the jungle roof on Guadalcanal. Persistent, greenish, eerie. Then our rockets roared overhead in a dreadful hissing barrage that must have been terrible to receive. Someone within the crater muttered that the Japs had carved a gap in our lines and that the rockets were being used to plug the hole with steel. I tried to snatch moments of sleep, lying against the crater rim with my helmet over my eyes, but it was impossible. The night passed like an interminable waking nightmare. We met the heat of morning with dried mouths, and lips that were beginning to crack, and stomachs grumbling with unrequited hunger. The heat began to rise again, refracted off the coral surface of Peleliu, baking the atmosphere, encompassing us in an oven.
"Let's go," said Lieutenant Deep Chest.
"Right," I said, and told Filthy Fred and the twin to get their gear on. We left the hole and made for an opening in the scrub to the left, through which the airfield was visible. It was early morning. We passed two Marines lying in their foxholes, asleep. I bent to wake them.
"Hey," I said, shaking one of them. "Wake up, we're moving out."
He did not answer. He lay inert. I rolled him over. There was a bullet hole in his head. He was dead. So was his comrade. Through the gap in the scrub, I could see F Company attacking again. The artist was standing there watching them. The mortars had stopped. The first F Company wave was advancing across the airstrip, running low with ranks scattered, breasting a withering machine gun fire that had begun to rake the runway. They were falling. It seemed unreal. It seemed a tableau. Phantasmagorical, like a scene from a motion picture. It required an effort of mind to recall that these were flesh and blood Marines, men whom I knew, whose lives were linked with mine. Still more was required in facing up to the fact that my turn was next. And here is the point in battle where one needs the rallying cry. Here, where the banner must be unfurled, or the song sung, or the name of the cause flung at the enemy like a challenge. Here is mounted the charge, the thing as old as warfare itself, that either overwhelms the defense and wins the battle, or is broken and brings on defeat. How much less forbidding might have been that avenue of death that I was about to cross had there been some wholly irrational shout, like Vive l'Empereur, or the Marine Corps forever. Rather than that educated voice which said in a sang-froid that was all at odds with the event. Well, it's our turn now. I bade goodbye to the artist. He looked at me sadly from beneath his helmet, his face made darker and more angular by its shadow. He cast a rueful glance in the direction of the airstrip and the still falling men. "Good luck, kid," he said, and turned away. I began to run. The heat rose in stifling waves. The bullets whispered at times. At other times, they were not audible. I ran with my head low, my helmet bumping crazily to obscure my view, like waves rising around a small ship. In a moment, I could not see Lieutenant Deepchess or Filthy Fred. I was alone and running. There were men to my left, still falling. I ran and threw myself down, caught my breath, rose, and ran again. Suddenly, I ran into a shell crater full of men, and I stopped running. The crater was like an oasis. I had imagined there was no cover available on the airport, and suddenly this. It was not nearly as large as the one in the scrub where I had spent the night, but it was large enough to contain about 10 men. 4 of these were men from the 5th Marines, among whom was a wounded lieutenant, and the rest were men from my battalion, including the commander of F Company, Captain Dreadnought. They made room for me without a word, and suddenly, with the sound of enemy shells crashing around the hole, I realized that I had found cover indeed, but also the only feature on that entire airport which enemy gunners could see and shoot at. A heavy machine gun mounted at the lip of our crater, facing toward what we called the enemy built-up area, a cement and steel blockhouse and some barracks. The only above-ground structures on the island had also drawn those red and roaring missiles down on us. So far, one thing seemed to have saved us from destruction. The Japanese gunners, it was a land-mounted naval rifle as I discovered later, could not get their shells into our pit. They could neither lower nor raise nor shift their sights to the exact point which would land a missile among us. Regularly, with stomach-squeezing accuracy, those shells landed before, behind, and to the sides of our hole. Sometimes the shell came closer, whereupon we cringed while the fragments hummed nastily overhead, or sometimes they drew further away. "That one was close," someone murmured, when a specially loud crash rocked us. "Yeah," another whispered. "I sure hope they don't come up with any short shells. That might do it, you know." "Shut up!" Captain Dreadnought commanded fiercely. "Here," he said to his walkie-talkie man. "See if you can get that thing going. I want to talk to battalion." Walkie-talkie sat below me on the crater floor. He hunched his shoulders toward me and asked me to twirl certain dials. I did, but he could not seem to get through. There came the screech of a shell. I braced my back for it, even though I knew the ones you hear are not to be feared. But how fear the one that gets you, the one you do not hear? Another voice was audible now. The 5th Marines lieutenant who was wounded, who was, in fact, dying, as I learned later, was speaking by his walkie-talkie to his regimental commander.
"The glorious 5th Marines have gone through, sir," he was saying, "and have achieved their objective. We are now in contact with the 1st Regiment.
I looked at the lieutenant. He was young and possessed of those clean-cut, athletic good looks characteristic of West Point or Annapolis men. He was in pain now, and the ordeal was beginning to wear upon the discipline of his facial muscles. A shell screamed in and we ducked. It exploded with a shattering, squeezing roar. It was the closest yet. Captain Dreadnought shouted,
"Where's that fire coming from?"
The men looked dumbly at one another, shrugged, and contemplated the atmosphere, through which a fine dust was falling.
"Here, there, let me up there!" Captain Dreadnought shouted at the man on the machine gun. He crawled up to the crater lip and raised his head. He studied the built-up area and Bloody Nose Ridge rising to the left of it. Then he crawled back to his former position, drew forth his map, examined it, and made a random mark with his pencil. "Try battalion again!"
This time contact was made.
"Hello, battalion, this is Fox Company. Enemy artillery fire sighted at 128 George. Request fire, mission on same. Over."
Incredible. Captain Dreadnought had no more idea of the location of that enemy gun than he had of the shape of the enemy commander's nose. When he raised his head and took this hurried glance, he saw only the blasted face of Bloody Nose Ridge. Had he seen so much as a puff of smoke, which he did not, it would have been impossible still to gauge its exact position, still more to relate it to a map. The coordinates he gave battalion were based on hope and the law of averages. But he could expect more from the former. for the chances of his having hit upon the right spot were as great as his having called for fire upon the tip of the Japanese general's nose. In a moment, I heard the sound of our own shells roaring out towards 128 George. I looked at his tense, sunburned face and wondered if he was not too disturbed by the enemy shells still falling around the pit. But then he spoke, and I realized that his stupidity was matched at least by his courage. "How many men here from the 1st Marines?" he asked. We raised our hands. "Six, eh? That ought to be enough. We'd better take that blockhouse over there. That's where all that machine gun fire seems to be coming from. As soon as this shell fire stops, we'll move out against it." Just like that. The blockhouse had resisted even naval gunfire. It had taken bombs point blank and remained standing. It was obviously covered by a maze of pillboxes. We, six of us, were to take it. Captain Dreadnought might be stupid, but no one could say that he was not gallant. I felt disgusted and resigned myself to an unprofitable death. I looked at the men from the 5th, who were regarding us with wonder, and envied them for having retained diplomatic relations with the state of sanity. Their commander was hardly conscious now, but he had heard. He waved a hand weakly in our direction and grinned, as though to say, "You'll never make it, but there's no harm trying." And of course, to a dying man, I suppose there was no harm. It had been quiet for some minutes. The enemy bombardment had stopped, as though to confirm Captain Dreadnought in his miraculous powers. From behind came a rumbling noise, and peering out, I saw one of our Sherman tanks approaching, firing at the blockhouse. Captain Dreadnought was overjoyed. A tank. With a tank to aid us, we hardly needed anybody. Six was overwhelming. Captain Dreadnought might almost do it alone. We scrambled out of the crater and deployed behind the tank, which lumbered in the direction of the blockhouse. But the tank was now the object of the enemy gunners, and shells began to land around us again. The air buzzed and hummed again with vicious and invisible fragments of steel. It was not wise to stay close to this clanking behemoth. At that moment, the tank commander decided that it was not wise to remain such an obvious target, and shied his metal mount farther off to our right flank. The shells drove us back to the crater. Once again, walkie-talkie had difficulty with his apparatus. He could receive, but not send. Battalion was asking for positions. "You'd better report back to the command post," Captain Dreadnought said to me, "but come back out." I scrambled out and darted back to the scrub. As I reached the CP, the artillery fire increased. It grew furious for a minute or so, then ceased. I found Major Cher leaning against his pack with an expression of extreme disgust on his heavy jowled features. A few feet away were his walkie-talkie man and Eloquent, who had inherited my old job of keeping the battalion diary. I gave him our position and sat down to smoke. I was terribly thirsty, but still I smoked. "How is it out there, Lucky?" the major asked.
"Bad, sir," I said, adding nothing, for my notion of this battle was still a confused jumble of men and movement and explosions, in which a blistering hot airfield was somehow involved. I sat and smoked, enjoying the small shade of the scrubs. Then I arose and said, "I'd better get back out." The major nodded and waved, "Good luck."
I struck out more to our right flank, because the artillery had begun again. As I walked, I came upon a Japanese rifle, which had been thrust into the ground by its bayonet. Odd. I approached it to examine it. Perhaps it was booby-trapped. I came up to it and looked it over curiously, and there came the sharp crack of a rifle and the ping of a bullet passing me. Another report, a puff of dust behind me. "Get out of here, you fool. It's a sniper's trap. The rifle is his aiming stake." The cool brass of him, operating right inside our CP. I came to an ammunition dump,
which had been set up on the edge of the airstrip. Stretcher bearers were bringing in a wounded man. A bullet had pierced his shoulder, and blood oozed thickly from a ragged hole. He was in a gay mood, laughing, looking up at the men who had brought him back, as though to say, "I've got mine, boys.